Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the brand new edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast.
I'm Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
I'm Alex Crook from TalkSport and national newspaper Scribe.
And I'm Michelle Owen from Soccer Saturday and Sky Sports News.
Coming up this week, we speak to NBC commentator Arlo White about switching studio for Seattle.
That's what I wanted to be, and although these experiences in cricket were magnificent, I was looking at the next 15, 20, 25, 30 years, and I certainly didn't want to be on cricket tours for that period of time, because I'd now be single.
Did Neil Warnock drop me a hint he will retire again at the end of the season?
And after a Super Sunday stand-up with Sarri, Sky Sports' Patrick Davison gives us his top tips on how to question under pressure managers.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Hello, guys. Crook, nice of you to tear yourself away from the pool and join us this week.
Do you know what? I'd love to say it's fantastic to be back, but it really isn't. I much prefer listening to the podcast with a beer on my sunbed than I do to contributing.
Oh, really? Oh, well, at least you hopefully have put it down this week. What's great, by the way, about last week is the immensely positive feedback that Michelle and I got in your absence.
Speaking of positive feedback, our conversation yesterday wasn't particularly positive, was it? 27 minutes of Matterface basically ranting about Chelsea and Maurizio Sarri. I've never heard so many expletives in one telephone call.
Yeah, dancing on ice went well this weekend. I enjoyed Brighton Burnley, and the less said about Manchester City Chelsea, the better. We haven't got enough bleeps, and I haven't got one of those explicit 18 plus ratings on iTunes.
guys, what a weekend it was. So many twists and turns at the top and the bottom of the Premier League. Let's look at the big headlines in numbers.
The Geek Sheet, this week in numbers.
Paul Pogba hit double figures for the first time in his career by netting twice in Manchester United's win over Fulham. 33% of the Frenchman's goals this season have come in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's 11 games in charge.
Cardiff left it late to topple Southampton in a crunch bottom of the table tussle. The Bluebirds have failed to score a first half goal in 20 of their 26 matches this season.
Burnley dragged Brighton back into the relegation danger zone with a 3-1 triumph at the Amex. The Claret's 7 matches unbeaten is their best run in the top flight since 1975.
Impressive. Tottenham kept themselves in the title shake-up with a 20th victory of the season at home to Leicester. The only time they've won more of their opening 26 games was during the 1961 double-winning campaign.
Chelsea's humiliating 6-0 defeat at Manchester City was the first time in 1,070 matches going back to 1991. Well done for counting that up, Crook. That was since their last conceded 6 goals in a single league game.
They still had cars parked behind the goals then, didn't they?
Probably. And talking of which, I did text someone who probably was around during those days. In fact, in 1991, he probably moved on, Pat Nevin. And after that match, and I just said to him, Pat, I think I'm going to cry. He responded very quickly with, well, you haven't got to write a 500-word positive analysis piece for the Chelsea website, have you?
That yeah, would have taken some doing.
The cars behind the stand, etc., a bit before my time. All three of us will, I'm sure, say that one of the most testing parts of our jobs is interviewing managers when they're under pressure or maybe when they've had a heavy defeat. We've had a couple of examples of it on the podcast in the recent weeks. The person who had the thankless task of quizzing Maurizio Sarri straight after the drubbing at the Etihad was Sky's Super Sunday touchline reporter, Patrick Davison. Patrick, welcome to the pod. Thanks for coming on. Just how difficult was that interview?
Thanks for having me. Do you know what? Not that bad. You obviously, normally on a day like that where it's gone very wrong for one guy, you start thinking that's the interview. So you're not too worried about it was Aguero and Sterling, Pep. You kind of think, well, they'll take care of themselves. But on that day, I mean, it wasn't even 76 minutes, was it? It was 24 minutes. You start thinking, right, Sarri's the one today. Then you sort of head round, 88, 89 minutes. Got the Chelsea press officer there, ashen-faced. And one thing that happens with Sarri, one thing I was mindful of was, would he want to speak in Italian? Because he did after the Arsenal game. And then Chelsea always want sort of a list of questions. Now, you'd normally be a bit reluctant about that because you think, oh, they're trying to control it. But I think with Sarri, because he's a bit worried about his English, so he wants as much of a heads up. And I've done it a few times now. He'll answer anything. But he walked in the room. He's absolutely fine. Had a little chat with him before we started. I said, do you want to speak about the handshake? I said, because I hadn't sort of forewarned him about that. I said, because I think it would look better for you. Because I don't think it was a case of him snubbing Guardiola or being sort of angry with anything Pep had done on the touchline. I was watching the two of them. There's nothing sort of gone on. They obviously like and respect each other. I never got round to it in the end. But he gave long answers. I'd normally, in most interviews, I don't know what you guys think, but start with something quite open and sort of try and pick up on his mood. But he was fine. And there was the bit at the end, obviously, where we had two or three in this situation. And I felt like with every question, I learned a bit less. But he was, at the end of the interview, as I was putting the mic down, he held his hand out. So it was one of them. I probably thought it was going to be worse than it was.
Mm. Well, at least you didn't have to do a David Craig and separate an angry manager from a police officer.
I've already seen the... Well, he's gone... someone sent me a text yesterday, actually, saying he'd gone one up from what I did at Huddersfield. where I went to crowd and found the wrong guy. He's actually sort of getting in the midst of two of them, yeah. But, no, I've only seen like some stills of David. I hadn't actually seen...
Oh, it's brilliant.
Picture. I was stood next to Martin Tyler in the room when it all went off just before half-time in that Norwich-Ipswich game. But... I didn't notice at the time that David had got himself right in the middle of it.
He's a peacemaker, Craigie. He's a peacemaker. You got some great lines out of Maurizio Sarri. Like, you know, you asked him, are these group of players not able to do what you want them to do? And he basically said no. Do you find it sometimes it's a little bit harder when they agree with you?
Yeah, do you know what? Absolutely. And that's what kind of threw me at the end. You sort of, I don't know, when I go into them, I try and think, like, what would a fan ask? Also, what are the guys in the press conference, what are the newspaper journalists going to ask? And try and sort of shape it by that. But so you think, well, I can't... You don't enjoy an interview like that. I always get tweaks afterwards, and you probably do as well, saying, oh, you relish that, interview's out of order. But it's horrible doing it. Don't enjoy, especially someone like Sarri, who's charming, he's a gentleman, everything I've done with him so far, really enjoyed. But when someone fires back, and like he's done in previous weeks where he sort of says, yeah, can you motivate the players? Not really. Do you think you'd be speaking to the owner? Yeah, probably. It can actually throw you a little bit. I'd agree with that.
On the subject of speaking to the owner, he came out with that great line, didn't he, on Sky Italia, basically saying, if Abramovich does call, I'll be happy because I never really speak to him. I mean, I would suggest that's quite a dangerous statement.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you see that, when you've done your interview and that comes out via another channel, do you think to yourself, oh, I wish he'd said that to me?
You do sometimes. Like I said, I do often have a think, especially for a big one like that, like what's going to be the back page. So I did, you can sometimes leave stuff out because of that. Like Spurs Newcastle the other week, Mauricio Pochettino came in, and actually, because of the way it had worked, he'd done his BBC one first. And he was really annoyed about being asked about why Fernando Llorente hadn't started. So he came in the interview, he's like, oh, you guys, I don't understand your job. Why are you asking me about that? So, and we had a little conversation before we started the interview about that. And kind of on the basis of that, I sort of thought, do you know what? I'm not probably going to go down that route because Fernando Llorente isn't going to be on the back page. So do I need to have a confrontation with this manager about that? Whereas if it's Kane, and if it is going to be on the back page, then you do have to go there. So you definitely, to answer your question, you're mindful of lines that other people might get and what else might come out. But I mean, look, I always think you feel more comfortable if you feel like, right, I've done my job. I needed to get into a mentality, approach, pressure and scrutiny that he might be under. So I felt like I'd done that. And then sometimes you can't control what they say, can you?
Patrick, when you were asking these questions, you kept plugging away. You asked Sari to clarify his comments and things. But you have your earpiece in. So is the producer back in the studio urging you to get him to keep going, or is that your decision?
No, that's my decision. I think the best interviews are when you're listening. So I can't remember when it was. It might have been sort of 70 minutes. Producer comes through. I try and get a bit of an understanding of what like Jamie Carragher might say. Graham Souness and Jamie Redknapp in the studio as well that day. Try and listen to Gary Neville. So you want to do an interview that is kind of in line with what the rest of the show is doing, that fits what the sort of the line of Super Sunday is. But so, to be honest, I don't enjoy it if someone's chipping in my ear all the way through. If someone, mid-answer, would key through to me and say, look, remember, you've got to ask him about his position, then I don't mind that. But if you're trying to listen, and obviously sometimes you've got the show going out in your ear as well, so the more things you have going on in your ear, the less you can listen to the guy you're speaking to. So what I tend to do is have a little chat towards the end of a game, maybe get a little message in my ear just before the interview starts. But I prefer from that point on for it to be kind of down to me, because I think, well, not that I'm particularly good at it, but I certainly got better when I stopped thinking about what the next question is going to be all the time and just stop and listen. And I think that can make a massive difference.
You did ask Maurizio Sarri, will you be sitting down with the people who run Chelsea to decide if you'll still be the manager? Because he'd already said yes to a similar question, and he'd said, that is something we have to do. And then when you went back to clarify it, he sort of said something slightly different, really. Yeah. I wonder how much harder it is when you've got a translator in the same room as you, and you're speaking to someone who's not discussing these big problems in their first language.
Yeah, I think you have to consider that. Cause I did one with Antonio Conte last season, like when they lost 4-1 at Watford. And I felt like I pressed too hard. Like I listened to it back and it sounded kind of aggressive. And I think if you are speaking to someone not in their first language, if you press too much, it doesn't kind of come off well. Because like I said, so with Sarri, the first question, you're just expecting an answer. And then I'm thinking, right, chances are I'll leave it here. But then he gave me a lot more than I expected. So I asked again. And then actually, you're right, I think it was his second or third answer on that topic. He actually seemed to undo a lot of what he said in the first two answers. So then I think you get to the point where you do have to leave it. If it's someone... obviously, I think it was French, but someone like that last season, he was under a lot of pressure. But I think then you can push and push, because Arsene Wenger understands absolutely. He's always an amazing post-match interviewee. So then you can force, because he knows what you're saying. So then you can afford to be probably a little bit more pushy, I think.
You picked out Arsene Wenger there. It always used to make me chuckle whenever Jeff Shreves interviewed Sir Alex Ferguson. If Fergie was happy with the line of questioning, he would always end the interview by saying, "Well done, Jeff." And if he thought Jeff had given him a difficult time, he didn't say that. I mean, with that in mind, who's been your most difficult post-match interviewee? Is there one interview that stands out in your memory?
Probably. I'm weighing up two here. Van Gaal on Boxing Day, where I got the stare, which a lot of people remember, because I can remember him.
The famous
it
one.
Was just a, yeah, it was just about... You know what? I feel like, I don't know if this is sort of hindsight, you get your Christmas schedule through, I don't know, maybe a month, maybe more before, and you think, this is Stoke Man United, it's 12 o'clock kickoff, and you just think, Boxing Day may be the one day where you just want, like, kind of a nice, easy day with two managers who are fine, they both play well. But Van Gaal was already under pressure, so you think Boxing Day, 12 o'clock. I remember meeting my producer at Beaconsfield Services at, I don't know, about 7 in the morning on Boxing Day. So it's on your mind, Christmas Day, that it's probably going to be a bad one. And then, I can't remember what time Stoke scored their goals that day. But it was clear, I think, from a couple of minutes out, probably a bit like City-Chelsea at the weekend, that it was going to be a bad, bad day. And I remember we were about to go off air. It was like 4 or 5 minutes before we went off air. So he's like, right, Pat, this is going to be a live interview. So he's standing there going, oh, no. And then you can hear the floor manager who's outside the Man United dressing room, right, manager's on his way. So I can remember lots of little details about the sort of the stress of that. And I can also remember that stare, because obviously he's walking off, but it felt like he almost walked into the wall at the far end, because he just kept his neck almost did a 360, just staring at me. He's like, I stayed there for a good half an hour looking down at my shoes, making sure he definitely left the room. And then there was... it wasn't post-match. I can remember the first time I interviewed Sir Alex, because I've never listened to it back. It's Man United Newcastle in the League Cup. Would it have been Carling Cup then? I can't remember. But he strides out, and it was always like the Emperor is entering the room. It wasn't like when, it's the difference when it was David Moyes the next year, because he'd sort of sneak down the side of the tunnel and it'll be very quiet and he just wanted to be left alone. Whereas with Sir Alex, it was always like a big deal when he entered a room. And then John Smart, who's the floor manager, said he was called Sir Alex Gaffer. He said, "How's it going, Gaffer? This is Patrick, new reporter." Nothing. Didn't look at me. Didn't speak.
Wow.
Nothing. Then he stood in front of me, and you've got to wait, obviously, till the guys
so
in the truck are all lined up. So there's always like 10 seconds, and obviously it felt like forever. And then... the first time he made eye contact, John Smart said, "Right, we're ready to go." So I started to speak, and then he looked at me. And honestly, that question must have been, I can't listen to it back, because I know how nervous I felt. And I mean, I kind of managed to get the words out in the end, but that was a pretty terrifying experience. And then Klopp last year was quite interesting.
Oh, he always saves one every now and again, doesn't he? Listen, Pat, thank you very much for coming on and talking us through
no worries,
the weekend.
Okay.
We appreciate it, and we'll speak to you soon.
Speak soon. Cheers, guys. Bye.
Oh, I love Pat. He's absolutely brilliant and one of the nicest guys on the touchline, isn't he, Crook?
No, he was superb. And I can relate to that Fergie story, actually, because the only time I've really ever been nervous in the company of a manager was with Sir Alex. I was writing the foreword with him for Paul Parker's autobiography, and I arranged to meet him at the team hotel. And I was so nervous that at the end of the chat, which went really well, I had a copy of his autobiography and I asked him to sign it. And when he said, "Who's it to?" I said, "It's to Alex," and then spelt his own name out, A-L-E-X. What a numpty.
Oh, dear.
Oh, amazing.
By the way, Sergio Aguero hit the headlines this week by equaling Alan Shearer's record of 11 hat-tricks. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just wondered why it wasn't in the headlines, because that's quite a big sort of statistic, Crook. Did you not?
Because everybody knew that. Oh, you know, I thought we were trying to give people information they couldn't get elsewhere.
Not because it was Manchester City or anything. he's got 5 of the Premier League hat-tricks that have been scored since 2018, and there's only been 11 of them. Salah's got 2, Kane's got 1. It's pretty impressive that, if you think that he's got 5 out of the 11 hat-tricks that have been scored in 13 months. But here's a question for you. Do you know where the term hat-trick originates from?
When I was a kid, I always used to wonder, actually. And I still don't know. So I'm intrigued to find out.
Do you think it's something to do with magic?
Well, yeah, like magicians and rabbits out of hats and stuff.
Okay. All right. Crook, got any ideas?
I guess I'd say maybe is a cricketing term originally, but again, I'd be guessing.
Okay. Well, we will tell you before the end of the pod. Have a think. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks, and NBC's Arlo White will join us very shortly.
Shots on a Friday.
Back in the net!
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the Championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It's the part of the show where we introduce this week's special guest geek. He's a Leicester City fan who has gone from covering non-league football for Radio Derby to being the lead commentator on NBC Sports in America. Sam caught up with Arlo White at Brighton on Saturday.
Well, first of all, I have to apologise because what number attempt at doing an interview for the Geeks is this? Three,
I believe
four?
This is the third. So after two really good rehearsals, I thought we were very strong in rehearsals. So
we were. Yeah. One of the Emirates, that was really good.
That
wasn't
was good.
It?
Was
we
excellent.
Did that twice.
Yes. So here we are now at Brighton. And this is for real now.
And this
it?
Is definitely yeah. for real. Listen, thank you very much for agreeing to do it again. Although I think it's probably better because the last time we sat down, it was in the aftermath of Leicester's 4-3 dramatic defeat to Wolves. So you might have been a little bit distracted.
I'm in a far better mood now.
That's good. I'm delighted to say that Arlo White is with us to talk about being NBC's lead Premier League soccer commentator. You haven't always been a soccer commentator. You've done so many other things as well. American sports, you've done the Super Bowl. You've also done cricket, test yep. matches and yep. bits and pieces like that. Just tell us how the journey started and how you went from being in a booth with Boycott to working with Dicko and Lasso on the biggest channel in America.
Yeah, well, that's right. And when you put it like that, Sam, it does feel like I've actually managed to cram a lot into a relatively short space of my career, because I didn't get into broadcasting, into the BBC at 5 Live until the age of 27. I remember answering an ad in the Monday Guardian and I got invited down for an interview, and I was perplexed as to why. What in that application actually made them believe that I could actually work for them? I thought I was part of some, I don't know, some BBC quota system or something. Maybe there weren't enough gingers there at the time. I've no idea. But having got down there, and when you interview for a job that you don't believe you have any chance of getting, it's amazing how relaxed you become. And I remember being on the train on the way back. I had to actually borrow the money to go down to the interview off my now wife. And I got a phone call from Human Resources, and they said, Arlo, we've got some news for you. And I thought, my goodness, they let you down quickly at the BBC. And they said, you surprised us. We'd like to give you a six-month contract to come and work for 5 Live. And I was absolutely speechless. And within 2 weeks, I was on the radio with Nicky Campbell. I was on the radio with Chris Moyles.
Wow.
And it was remarkable. So, I mean, fast forward a few years, and you start working your way up through the ranks. And, yes, covering cricket was great. I put my hand up to the now TMS producer, Adam Mountford, said I loved the sport. Football has always been number one, but I did love cricket, and do love cricket as well. And then ended up touring the world. But I thought, really, that cricket wasn't going to be me for the rest of my life. We had twin daughters by that stage, and travelling around for maybe 4 or 5 months per year, although you go to some very nice locations, it's tough. And eventually I wanted to be a football commentator, and that's where the Seattle Sounders came in.
And that is a consideration, is it, that not many people really think about, I suppose. I mean, with football it's slightly different, but you know, I think about Jonathan Ledyard, Adam Leventhal, who did a similar job to that, travelling around with Sky Sports News doing the cricket. When you have a family, when you have other commitments, tennis correspondents Russell Fuller, Jonathan Overend, they've been on the road for so many months of the year. It's very, very difficult, isn't it?
It is. And I can remember when Lizzie, my wife, was pregnant with the girls, that winter I was away for 4.5 months of her 7.5 month pregnancy.
Wow. So, where were you?
Well, it was India when I found out that she was pregnant. And found out it was twins. That was India. That was an interesting night.
Right, to FaceTime as well.
Exactly. And then it was Australia for a Commonwealth Bank one-day series.
Right.
And then after a week or two at home, it was the West Indies for the World Cup. But it wasn't the Barbados St Lucia leg. I was in Guyana for 3 weeks, which was a completely, on a BBC budget, was a complete nothing against Guyana. It's a lovely place. But it wasn't the most
glamorous.
Yes, salubrious surroundings, let's put it that way.
But all that travel didn't put you off when it came to relocating
years later?
No, because I knew that I wanted to be a football commentator, and I wanted to be true to the kid that used to take a tape machine. It's appropriate that the podcast has the word geek in it, because I've always been like that. I've always taken a tape machine, a recording Walkman, down to Leicester City matches when I was a kid. Much to the amusement of everybody around me in the old little East Stand along the side of the pitch. But that's what I wanted to be, and although these experiences in cricket were magnificent, I was looking at the next 15, 20, 25, 30 years, and I certainly didn't want to be on cricket tours for that period of time, because I'd now be single and, my girls wouldn't be living with me, because for obvious reasons. It's just very, very difficult to keep a relationship and marriage going in that situation. So, but football was the first calling. So going to Seattle was brilliant. It was a great opportunity. It raised a few eyebrows when it first came about, it was first suggested, because I got myself to a position at the BBC where I was doing good stuff, doing the cricket, doing Five Live Sport, Mark Pugach's deputy, and then all of a sudden you're chucking all that in to go and work in Major League Soccer. But I knew the size of the club. I knew that they were involved with the Seattle Seahawks. I knew that the co-founder of Microsoft was involved with them. So I knew they were doing things right, and it's been the best move I ever made, and I've never looked back, really.
And from MLS, you got picked up by NBC.
Yeah.
And then very quickly after that, you've got the Premier League rights. How was that transition?
So I moved out to Seattle for 2 years. NBC bought the rights to Major League Soccer and said, "Do you fancy coming over?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, absolutely." Because you also get to do, not only is it national, but you get to do the Olympic Games as well. And the Olympic Games football tournament is not big for us, but it's huge for the Americans, because obviously women's soccer being as big as it is there, and their team generally do very well in the tournament. So it was kind of a no-brainer, I suppose, in a way, to go across to NBC, although this time in Seattle was incredible. And then after a season and a half of doing MLS, it was announced that they'd spent $250 million on the Premier League, and it caught us all by surprise. By that time,
did you not know they were going for it when you took that job?
We heard whispers. But no, when I took the job at NBC, we had no idea they were going for the Premier League at all. This was their first foray into our sport. They'd never even done it before. So I guess I'm the only full-time football commentator NBC, this venerable organisation, has ever had to this day, which is a huge honour, I suppose. But then, 18 months into the MLS deal, they announced that the Premier League had been acquired, and my wife and daughter had just moved over to Connecticut. The furniture had been there for a month, and I was asked if I fancied going home. And I said, "Yeah, go on then. This is going to take some explaining when I go home." But it was one job I'd come back for, and that was it.
Yeah. How is the Premier League perceived by American viewers, and where does it rank in a list of what is a very big sporting landscape?
It's a very condensed market, but we are extremely viable. NFL is the king, as you know. I mean, I didn't see the final figure for who watched the Super Bowl, but it's normally around 100 million, isn't it? Yeah. You know, the conference championships had 50 and 40 million. Now, we will do games, not today, but usually the 5:30 game over here is on NBC. And, you know, we've been regularly getting 1.2s, 1.3s.
They didn't fancy Brighton versus Burnley, though.
I don't know. It must have been a scheduling clash, Sam. I'm not entirely sure.
With all due respect to the two teams, they've only ever shared one goal between them in the Premier League before today.
Exactly. You know, you watch it, it'll be a 5-4 today. No, it won't, will it? Let's be honest. So it's a young audience, so it's attractive to advertisers. And I think the sense I get, Sam, and this is what, you know, the beauty of social media, is that I get a sense that there's a young audience out there. There are families gathering together because it's Saturday morning and Sunday morning. So before they go out for their shopping or their daily whatever they do at the weekends, they can all gather on the sofa as a family. Whereas these days, it's very difficult to get everyone in the same room because of tablets and various devices and social media and that sort of thing.
And you've marketed that really well with the sort of hashtag Premier League morning, my Premier League mornings or whatever it is. And you have some social events as well, which sort of curated by Rebecca whilst you're live on air.
Yep.
Sort of, it looks very social, doesn't it?
Yeah, the fanfests are very, very important, because you get upwards of 6,000 people there that go through in shifts depending on which teams are playing, and we work in conjunction with all the fan groups out there, the supporters groups, of which there are many, and they're well populated and well supported. But it also combines that idea of yes, there are families watching at home, but there's also a huge population who are watching in bars. So if you go around any major American American City these days at you know 7-8 o'clock in the morning, you see shirts of virtually every Premier League team because they're all going to their various fan bars to watch the games.
Yeah.
So on the East Coast, the 3 o'clock games, I suppose, kick off at 10 in the morning. You know, it's a challenge on the West Coast for the 12:30 game. But even then, pubs will open if they are affiliated with a fan group. So that's what the Fan Fest does. It brings all those sort of people together.
So apart from Premier League, you have done other sports for, not necessarily for America, but in America. You did a Super Bowl at least once, three or four times actually, didn't you? Five of those.
Yeah.
Did you watch this one, by the way?
I did.
You stayed up like
I
did.
It.
You enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it.
It's a bit too much defensive.
Yeah, but I'm a Chicago Bears fan, and that's why. I mean, you give me a 13-7, and I'll love it. I'll absolutely love it. You know, okay, look, you know, what was it, 51-50, wasn't it, the Rams and the Chiefs earlier in the season?
Yeah.
Hated that. That's not real football.
That's not real football. The noise was deafening, though, in Atlanta, wasn't it?
Yeah.
An amazing stadium. Mm. It's an amazing arena.
Yeah.
Do you think that affected the game, do you think?
It could have done. What I found really interesting was that the MLS Cup final was held there a few months ago, Atlanta United, and the crowd was bigger for that than it was from the Super Bowl.
Wow.
73,000 against 70,000. Now, I'm pretty sure that that's because of,
segregation,
you know...
Yeah,
well, it'd be to do with cordoning off areas for corporates and for the media, but it's just interesting. It shows you the standard or the standing of football, soccer, in America, which is getting very, very big, and Atlanta is a hotbed for it. But that stadium is absolutely... I haven't been there, but I've seen all the behind-the-scenes video. That stadium is absolutely sensational.
And the president of that club, of course, used to work at Tottenham Hotspur.
Darren Eales.
Going back to the Super Bowl, sorry, I got distracted by the stadium. You have called it, as you said. What was the difference between calling a Super Bowl for radio and football, soccer, for television?
Two very, very different experiences. So I did five Super Bowls. They were all very good games, as I recall. Very close, going down to the wire.
Any 13-7s?
No 13-7s, but there was a 17-10. No, 17-13, which is when the Patriots' perfect season was ended by Eli Manning and Plaxico Burress, and David Tyree did the helmet catch. Super Bowl 42, that was incredible.
Did you do the one with the onside kick, 43?
Yes, which was the Saints against the Colts.
Yes.
Yep, we did that one. That was in Miami, that was fantastic. I think that was the last live sporting event I did for the BBC as a full-time employee of the corporation. And they're extraordinary experiences. I mean, I haven't done one for about 9 or 10 years. I'd love to do another one at some point in the future. But getting there for the week and seeing how they do things with Radio Row and every radio station kind of congregates in this big, massive conference hall, to see what England and Gareth Southgate and the FA did for, I'm sure you were there, I didn't get down there, but at Burton before they went away to the World Cup, they're learning from the NFL and the way they interact with the media, which I think is benefiting the FA and it's certainly benefiting the England football team. So it was interesting to see that Gareth was back out there for this Super Bowl as well. And I'm sure it's a great trip, and I'm sure there's a lot of fact-finding going on. But doing the Super Bowls, you had the worst seat in the house. You're often next to the Russians who drank beer in the first... The commentators drank beer in the first half and vodka in the second. They had someone there specifically to get their drinks ready. So I'd love to have listened to the fourth quarter of Russian commentary on that, but they were superb events to do.
Going back to football, you are a big Leicester City fan. We touched on it a little bit earlier on. Are you enjoying this season? Can you enjoy this season? I read a Leicester City Supporters Trust chairman say that Claude Puel was a little bit like Marmite, and then reveal that 2/3 of the support wanted him sacked.
So not... 2/3 of people don't like Marmite. It's a really odd situation. To a degree, having won the Premier League, it's almost like it doesn't really matter what happens. But it does. You kind of think that. But then
do you
think
you should have gone for the FA Cup a little bit more?
Oh, absolutely. And there's one major trophy that Leicester City haven't won. They've been in four finals, and I've got each programme from the final on my wall in a frame, thinking that was as good as it was going to get, you know, runners-up in the FA Cup. And it's the one thing that's missing. And I often wondered, and I think we'll look back on this, with that collection of players, you know, the main ones are gone, I suppose, now. Mahrez, Drinkwater, though he doesn't play anymore, Conte, Vardy's still there, and hopefully he stays. But I always felt that there was another trophy of some kind in that group. Not the Premier League, but then, you know, let's maybe go for the League Cup. Let's go for the FA Cup. And if the draw falls for you, as it has this year, there's only going to be two Big Six teams in the quarterfinals. And one of those, you know, one of those other six teams with a fair wind, could have been Leicester, but they really just didn't take it seriously down in Newport and got their comeuppance.
And this is not too long ago that you were the furthest progressing English team in the Champions League. Yeah. It wasn't that long ago. So there is a sort of cup sort of ethic about them.
Yeah, they're struggling for an identity at the moment, I think, because the thing I don't understand about the Puel reign so far is that the whole ethos was they needed to get away from, be less one-dimensional, get away from the counter-attacking football and create a more sort of modern style, if you like. Well, the results that people use to defend him, which was Chelsea, which was Manchester City, they played very well at Liverpool. I thought Liverpool was a tactical masterclass, actually. But that was kind of soaking up the pressure. But the wins have been counter-attacking. Mm. So I don't think it's been proven yet, or certainly not developed or matured, this style that's identifiable as Claude Puel. And I think people are confused. People are bored. I spoke to Danny Higginbotham
the other
day.
That's just the press conferences.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that must be tough. But Danny Higginbotham said the other day, he said one of the problems he's got is that these performances, the poor performances, are in front of the home fans. Yeah. So that is colouring their view of him. You know, as you know, a vast minority of people get to go to the away games, or occasionally the games are on TV, but it's the home games, the Cardiffs, the Bournemouths, you know,
they set the
agenda. List goes on, and people are bored out of their minds. So until something happens and something changes, I think the fans are always going to be sceptical.
Listen, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it. I think looking at the recorder, we've got through.
That's excellent.
Without any problems. So,
look, if not, are you at Chelsea next week? We can give it a fourth go.
Where am I next week? I don't even know. Oh, we've got FA Cup next week.
Oh, we have. Yeah. So I'm doing Doncaster Crystal Palace for 5 Live.
Are you?
Sunday afternoon.
Oh, yeah, good. So well, enjoy that. Yeah. I'm doing, what am I doing? I'm doing Newport versus Manchester City.
Excellent.
On Saturday night. Yeah. It'll be fun. Listen, thank you very much.
Cheers,
good
Sam.
Luck. Cheers.
Great to hear from Arlo there, but he must have been in the minority of people who really enjoyed that Super Bowl. That was like the Jose Mourinho of Super Bowls. I stayed up all night for it. I had an hour's sleep before flying off to Portugal the next day.
You don't even know anything about NFL.
No, but I did have £10 on the first touchdown score, and it came in. So, you know. It is great to hear from Arlo, because, of course, we were due to hear from him a couple of weeks ago, and Sam, you deleted the audio.
Yeah, as we covered in the interview, it was the fourth time we tried to do it. I'm very grateful for him. And he's come a very long way in a short space of time from when he was shadowing you when you were commentating at IMG all those years ago, Crook. When, you know,
where did it all go wrong for him?
Where did it all go wrong for you?
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
I was at Southampton against Cardiff on Saturday. Neil Warnock was in great form afterwards, as you can imagine, after such a dramatic victory. He gave me a teasing little line as well. Let's hear it.
I mean, he was such a nice lad. And I think it just shows you that, you know, you don't know what's around the corner, really. And as I've said to them, you know, this could be my last season. It might not be. But, you know, I want them to give me everything they've got while I'm, you know, I don't get any younger, me.
Is that a hint there that this maybe could be your last season?
No, I'll be here for 5 years, won't I?
Interesting.
He's a tease, isn't he? But it does back up what Michelle was actually alluding to, I think, a couple of weeks ago, that she had an inkling that perhaps, particularly if Cardiff stay up, actually, because what else could he do next season? Maybe we'll walk off into the sunset.
You just think about everything that he and the club have been through this season, and if he were to keep them up now, it would just be an absolute miracle. It would be, he said it himself, it would be the biggest achievement of his career.
Mm. Did he go in search of Gary Lineker again this week?
Not quite, but there was a funny moment because, of course, all the various TV interviews are cordoned off into little areas, and he walked into one curtain room and said, "Who's this for?" And they said, "BBC." And he said, "I better be careful what I say. You stitched me up last week." And it was only half tongue-in-cheek. He said it with a smile, but you could tell he meant it. What's he been like to deal with, Michelle, over the course of the season, Neil Warnock? Because I know you've been at a lot of his press conferences.
Yeah, an absolute delight. I mean, I personally get on with him really well, which obviously helps a lot. He's helped me with a few things as well. He is he's a nice bloke. He has this rep among opposition fans, you know, the whole Colin thing and the BBC thing and the Gary Lineker thing was quite funny, wasn't it? Let's be honest. But he's genuinely a lovely man. And I think a lot of people sort of saw that emotion after everything that had happened recently. But every week he gives you a soundbite. Every week he gives you something. His presses are probably too long, 45 minutes. Compare that to, I remember Jose Mourinho did that 3-minute presser back in October, whenever it was. And I was at Neil Warnock, who did like 35, 45 minutes. And he just gives you something every single week. And so to the press, he's brilliant. And on a personal level as well, he's just a nice bloke.
And he's a great ambassador for Cardiff City. And I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that he gives you a soundbite every week, because I think Cardiff get more coverage. I know it's been a very difficult time recently, but I think Cardiff get more coverage than probably Cardiff City, the football club, and its situation, notwithstanding the tragedy that's just happened, actually deserve in terms of how high they get up in Sky Sports news bulletins, in paper bulletins, because he gives you something to say. It gives you a story to discuss, which is actually quite interesting. So I think he does. He's a great PR man for Cardiff City as well, which think is really, really important for them. And then when they lose him, and eventually they will do, it will be interesting to see, you know, how many people pay attention to what's going on at that club, especially if they're not in the Premier League. And it's interesting because he's obviously making the most of it, a bit like Sean Dyche and Chris Hughton. I was down in the tunnel doing live interviews for Talksport on Saturday night with Chris Hughton and with Sean Dyche of Burnley. And, you know, we talk about dealing with managers under pressure like Maurizio Sarri at the top of the programme, and you can often get short shrift from managers who are feeling the heat. I agree with Pat, actually. I think Sarri was all right at the weekend, despite the fact that after the Arsenal game, he didn't want to do radio and he threw a bit of a strop. But two men who will talk, rain or shine, win or lose, Chris Hughton and Sean Dyche, they're absolute gentlemen. They're erudite, they're confident, they're calm. They're always very polite as well, which, you know, is worth something. I had to grill Chris Hughton a little bit. They've scored twice in, well, they've scored once in two home games. They've had over 20 shots in those games. And, you know, the only goal they've got in 2019 at home was that consolation goal they scored against Burnley. But he answered it. I pushed him again and he dealt with it. He's a sensible, intelligent man, and he sounds like he's in control. And actually, if I was a supporter, listening to the way he responded to those questions that were pushing a few buttons, I would think, actually, this is a guy I can trust to sort of get us through the situation. Same with Dyche. I think he always deals with quite aggressive questioning. I remember the Moose did an interview with him earlier in the season. And a lot of managers would have bitten his head off and gone absolutely crazy about the question that he, well, not question, the opinion that he gave, that they were, you know, they were shocking and it was out of order that they played that way. But Dyche never accepted that. And he actually mentioned that in the interview that I did. He said, "I've always defended these players because I think they've been brilliant all season." He was excellent on Tom Heaton. That's a controversial situation. He's had to drop Joe Hart. But the way he's handled that as well, I think, is very impressive. Because let's face it, you know, Tom Heaton's come back into the team. They haven't lost since then. And they've conceded 6 goals in 7 matches. It's pretty it's pretty clear that that's made a massive, massive difference. But the way he's handled that is that Tom Heaton's great rather than Joe Hart was, you know, not doing what he was supposed to do. I think that's...
Yeah, absolutely. And Chris Hughton as well, as you mentioned there, it amazes me, actually, the amount of stick he's getting at the moment from Brighton fans. Yes, they're on a bad run. But listen, this is someone who, when they took over, it was an absolute car crash under Sammy Herpy. They were heading for League One. He kept them in the Championship. Mm-hmm. They had a couple of near misses with the playoffs. And then finally, he got them promoted, kept them up with ease last season. Everyone thought they would get to April and May and then be relegated because they had such a tough end to the season. Yes, they're going for a difficult patch. All teams in the lower echelons of the Premier League are going to go through that run. Mm-hmm. But for Brighton fans to criticise him, be careful what you wish for. If you are going to stay in the Premier League, he's the best man to keep you there.
Absolutely. And also, the same with Dyche.
Yeah, also those managers you've just mentioned, Neil Warnock, Sean Dyche and Chris Hughton, all managers that are battling relegation, battling to keep their teams up, and they're all a joy to deal with. Yeah. It's just a food for thought, isn't it? For those managers at the top with all the money, with the big clubs, politeness, I think, buys you a lot of credit with journalists.
And funniness. Any sort of comedy goes down really well. Because Dyche was really good because we've got Stuart Pearce, they're old mates. And I was talking to him and I was saying, Stuart Pearce has got a cold, otherwise he would have come down and done the interview with me. And he said, yeah, I've had a text message from him. He said he's got a cold and a bit of the flu, so he wasn't going to come down and say hello to me in the dressing room because he was afraid of spreading the flu. At which point Dyche said, which is weird because I think he's gone soft because he never used to be like that. Clearly, he started listening to garage music instead of punk,
which of course is Stuart's audio of choice. And it's, yeah, it's little touches like that, a bit of fun towards the end of the interview. You just think, you know, personable kind of guy. Great.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd call Stuart pissed off, not to his face anyway.
Yeah, it was all right down in the tunnel when I was about 20 metres away from him. And one of the, actually, I went back upstairs afterwards and he went to me, "You're never happier, are you, than when you're winding everybody up?" That's absolutely true.
We know that on this podcast. Just picking up what Michelle was saying there about managers at the bottom being courteous and, as you say, trying to maybe deflect the attention from their players with some humour. I thought Ralf Hasenhüttl was great also on Saturday night. I got a one-on-one interview. You could tell he was absolutely boiling with anger inside, you know, having got back into that game to concede in stoppage time after another defensive error. How many points is Southampton going to throw away in the last moments of matches? But again, he was courteous. He answered the questions. He took responsibility. He promised he's going to put things right. They've gone to Tenerife now. He says it won't be a holiday. And having seen him at close quarters, that they're going to be working their socks off in the sunshine. He's having 20-minute one-on-ones with all the players to tell them exactly where they're going right, exactly where they're going wrong. Again, I think if they're going to stay up, he's the best man to keep them there. But again, Southampton fans, after the upturn, are turning him on Twitter.
Well, you've obviously fallen for his charm, haven't you? Because you think he's fantastic, but they are in the bottom three. And they've got to go away to Arsenal next. They've got to go away to Manchester United soon. They've got Tottenham Hotspur at home. April doesn't look particularly friendly. They've got Liverpool at home, then Wolves down at St Mary's, and their last fixture of the season is against Huddersfield, so they should be all right with points there. But away to West Ham before that, it's not going to be easy, is it?
No, and I do think he's made it more difficult because he was the one who was leading the drive to get players off the wage bill in January, the likes of Cedric Suarez, who for me could still do a job there, Gabby Adini perhaps, because they're badly short of goals. But he only wanted to work with 18 senior players plus some youngsters. At the moment, that gamble looks like it might backfire because they are back in the bottom three and you just can't see where the goals are going to come from. But I'm sure, having got rid of those players, he would have liked the board to sanction one or two incomings as well. That didn't happen. They were flirting with Che Adams. So I always thought this season, if they go down, it's largely going to be Mark Hughes' fault, not Ralf Hasenhüttl. I don't really think you can judge him until he's had a chance to get his own players in there and really make his own imprint on the side.
But he left in December.
Yeah, but he left them an absolute shambles, Sam. Let's not, you know, beat around the bush. If Mark Hughes was still in charge, they would be in a Huddersfield-Fulham situation where you'd be thinking already they've got no chance.
He was on this podcast that he didn't sign some of the players that were signed in the summer. Listen, he certainly didn't allow Dusan Tadic to leave. He would never have allowed that to happen, but the club did. So
he's put that message out since he was removed of a position of power. I was in press conferences where Mark Hughes would say, "Yes, we've got a recruitment department, but I get the final say on signings." Which one is it?
He had to say that when he was an employee of that club, didn't he?
I think the truth is probably somewhere in between.
Yeah, exactly. And it was in December, and they've had a lot of matches since then. So, you know, it will be a joint responsibility if they go down, I think.
Michelle, where were you on Saturday?
I was at Swansea City v Millwall, and the funniest thing happened when I was walking in. I walked in behind this guy who was the spitting image of Graham Potter, like an older version, identical. And I was like, is that some relation? Who is that? And then I just kept catching glimpses of him. It was like seeing Graham Potter in sort of 20 years' time. And then I got to post-match. I was like, "Graham, is your dad here today?" And he's like, yeah, he is. That's me in 6 games' time. And I was like, right, I'm not going mad. I have seen an older version of Graham Potter wandering the corridors of the Liberty. But yeah, another decent win for Swansea. Absolute carnage at that club right now. Hugh Jenkins has resigned. He'd been there for 17 years. The new American owners, the fans want them out. There were fan protests before the game where people on Twitter saying, "Make sure you mention it. Make sure you mention what's going on in your reports." And obviously you do a line on it. But as you know, we only get 20 seconds or so. So fair play to Swansea. I don't know how Graham Potter's doing it. I don't know how he's doing the job he's doing. He's got them 6 points off the playoffs at the time of speaking. He is an incredible manager. And if they have another fire sale in summer, which I expect they will, because they're massively in debt, if another club comes in for Graham Potter, is he going to stay there?
No, he's just moved his whole family over from Scandinavia to take a job in the Championship, and he's had the rug pulled from underneath his feet. So he's well within his rights to do whatever he can to stay in employment in this country.
And he said recently about his son, he's sort of questioning, you know, "Oh, I miss my friends. Why did we come over here?" And you hear like stories like that. You're like, "Oh, that's got to hurt when Graham Potter is in that club doing a fantastic job and not getting any backing."
Yeah, it's amazing the way that Swansea have gone from being one of the best-run clubs in the Premier League to just being an absolute shambles in a relatively short space of time. One club who are not in a shambolic state is the other club you cover on a regular basis, Bristol City. I mean, eight wins in a row. Lee Johnson must feel about 10 feet tall, mustn't he?
Well, he's definitely not 10 feet tall. But
Only if he stood on Michelle's shoulders. Even then it'll be a struggle, to be fair.
It would still be a struggle. I'm pretty short as well. Might make it to 9-9. I'm down there tonight, actually, and it's just incredible. Lee Johnson gets so much stick off Bristol City fans, quite simply because they don't like him. They didn't like him as a player, and they don't like him being there as a manager. You can't argue with what he's doing right now. Lost their three best players in summer, eight wins in a row in all competitions, 13 unbeaten going into tonight's match against QPR, and they're in the playoffs. They're up there with the likes of Derby and West Brom, clubs that have a fair bit of money to spend. Bristol City have to be really careful financially because they're near the financial fair play limit because of one reason or another, which to me just blows my mind. I don't understand how they are when you look at other clubs spending. But he's got the club to gel together. He's got the team to gel together. And he is one of the best young English managers in the Football League. If he does carry on like he is, it can't be long until, with respect, bigger teams come sniffing round.
Well, he's got them above Derby County and Aston Villa in the leagues, and that's no mean feat. He's got to go away to Norwich very shortly, so it's going to be a little bit difficult to see if they can keep that winning run going. They've got Leeds at home on the 9th of March as well, so the Championship's a tough, tough league, and they went on a brilliant run last season, didn't they? And then, once the wheels came off, they dropped like a stone. So
yeah, I'm not convinced they'll finish in the playoff places, to be honest. I'd love to see them do it, but I don't think they will. I'm just not quite sure they're there just yet. It's a season of transition for them. But if you look at what they're doing now, they're punching above their weight, for sure. The teams you've mentioned there. So fair play. It's nice to see another, you know, we just mentioned some English coaches there. It's nice to see another one doing very well.
Such a tough league, the Championship. I mean, I'm playing manager mode on FIFA at the moment, and I'm in the Championship. And every week I'm thinking, right, I'm going to have an easy game this weekend. Then you play an Aston Villa, you know, or a Derby County. Honestly, I've got no easy
fixtures.
It's
basically the same, isn't it? You know,
it is.
It's the same. Yeah. Completely the same. That's exactly what it's like, playing FIFA, managing the Championship. Nail on the head.
Let's move on. Do you want the answer to where the term hat-trick came from?
Yes, please. I'm dying to know.
Okay.
Did you want a drum roll there or something?
No, I've got a stab to go in there.
Oh, right.
So I left a gap for the stab. So, you know, cheers for ruining it, though.
Oh, my God, an insane goal!
The language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Okay, here we go then. Now, the term first appeared, and Crook, you'll like this, in cricket in 1858. But maybe not in the way that you expect, because it was Heathfield Harmon Stevenson. In 1858, he took three wickets with three consecutive deliveries, and fans at the ground held a collection for him and presented him with a hat brought with the proceeds. Mm. And that's why it's called hat-trick. So a guy takes three wickets in three consecutive deliveries. They're so impressed by it, the supporters. They raise a little bit of money. They go out, buy the guy a hat and say, there you go. That's for getting three out of three. Well done. And that's where the term hat-trick comes from. It was eventually adopted by, you know, football, water polo, handball, hockey, everything now. But that was the first recorded incident of it. And the first time it was used in print was 1865.
What's the trick bit? I don't get it. I get that they bought him a hat, but why is it a trick?
Well, because he's obviously done a trick to get a hat. So you've done a trick which gets you a hat. So it's a hat trick.
Clear as mud. No, that is interesting. And I think it's something that folks listening at home won't know about. So I'm enjoying this.
Well, you didn't know.
Well, I sort of knew, didn't I?
Not really. You just
I was hoping it was going to be something magical.
You thought it was going to be something magical. That sounds quite magical. People reacting in a crowd to something that's happened and all coming together, joining forces to provide a present to a guy who's impressed them. That's nice. That's quite magical, no?
It's nice. It is nice. Yeah.
Okay.
I was thinking more Harry Potter. My bad. That's all we have time for this week. Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handles are exactly the same, at AFC Geekston. Join us again next week.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.